This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Tom Albrecht, who is an artist and a professor of art at the University of Illinois. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks very much.
And we're talking to you by phone, and you're at a very lovely spot, Cape Cod. How do you happen to be there?
I'm actually doing some work over this past weekend for a conference that's taking place in Providence, Rhode Island, and I happen to be staying with my parents who live on the Cape.
What kind of work is going to be at the Providence show?
Well, it actually occurred on Friday and again today. There was a bit of a rain delay yesterday, so things were a little bit washed out. Quite heavy rain going on in Providence, but did some performance slash interruptions, as I like to call them, street performances on the streets of Providence. So that it was quite interesting.
I want to ask more about that, but just as a very start of a question, as a professional artist, you do visual art, and we'll talk about some of the pieces you've had on display here at the Krannert Art Museum and at the University Y. Things you've done at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts were more in the nature of this, I guess, the piece you did today. Tell us the difference between visual art and performance art.
I think that in some sense, with drawings or with paintings, the way I was trained, one could consider them to be more static objects, where the interaction really is between the person viewing the work on the wall or within a given space, and the encounter that really happens between one individual or a series of individuals within that particular space. And what I'm doing right now, really in the past year or so, a slight shift in my work has been taking that sort of interaction that occurs within sort of oftentimes an enclosed space such as a gallery or museum and bringing it into a much more open environment, in many cases now urban street environments, where the encounter is not expected and oftentimes interrupts the flow of traffic or the experience of a particular space by what occurs with the piece itself.
Now, we're particularly interested in our announced topic for this hour in our conversation with you and with callers who call with questions and comments is moral art.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you take art into the public and you interrupt people who are doing something else, does that immediately call into question whether it's moral or not? I mean, you're interrupting them. Isn't that rude?
Well, it depends on, I guess, how you're looking at the work and how you're actually even encountering a work, or even if you're paying attention. I think that a number of the works that I've been doing over the course of the past year have involved fairly innocuous, rather benign sort of actions. This would be different than the event that occurred at the Krannert Performing Arts Center last fall on 9/11, which we had a previous conversation about. Some of the projects that I've been working on since that time have involved, very sort of subtle interventions into public space on a street where there might be one individual or two or three individuals that perform an action or call out a bit of language to sort of interrupt the flow of traffic or the flux of things that are occurring on a street. What occurred this past weekend in Providence was I was dressed up to look somewhat like a street preacher, or I could have been a business person. I could have taken on any number of roles, but I also was carrying with me a soapbox, an old wooden box that I put down on the street corner, stood on top of it, and called out in different ways, different intonations, "I've lost faith." And I moved through several different neighborhoods on the east side of Providence around Brown University and Rhode Island School of Design, and then went into downtown Providence to the bus depot and to the Capitol and did this sort of performance piece.
So you were alone. You were dressed as a business person or a street preacher. You stood on the soapbox. You cried out, "I've lost faith."
Correct.
And people responded?
People did respond. People either would follow along and sort of see where I would go next. They would pause and make comments to one another. A few sort of called out. Nothing really pejorative, which actually was surprising to me. Many people sort of nodded or gave me the thumbs up. What I was trying to sort of encounter with people was a certain kind of what I perceived to be an anxiety in the current culture with a certain loss of faith in an ideal, whether that be with government, whether that be with one's religious faith, whether that be a belief that there's any such thing as hope anymore or belief in sort of government action. Here or abroad, I was interested in how you take a cliche like "I've lost faith" without following it with any other sort of language and allow the bystanders who encounter that bit of language to sort of encounter it and take it up and consider what that phrase might mean for them. Mm-hmm. So in that way, I think it's different than Perhaps work that I've done in the past, which may have a more explicit meaning attached to it that the viewer might take in based on viewing the work. The work that I've been doing out on the street seems to be a bit more fluid and a lot less fixed. I'm interested in how that plays out.
Now, this is art just of the moment, or is it in some way recorded, or do you preserve it in any way?
Well, in many of the instances, it has been documented, as it likes to be called in visual art. Documentation has taken the form of audio recordings, videos, and still images taken of the actual events. This past weekend, however, I did not document anything. I was interested in seeing how it would be if it was completely ephemeral, if it just existed at that moment with the individuals that were there, with no record of it, except what they would carry with them. There were very many individuals who were taking digital still images with their cell phones. So there are images that exist in the world of these happenings, but I don't have control over what happens to them now. So I'm also interested in that.
Were there any witnesses other than yourself and the people who responded to you? I mean, did you tell friends you were going to do this? Did you tell colleagues about it?
It was part of a weekend-long group of activities that was set up beforehand. So there was prior publicity on the web regarding this and in local publications. So I did not publicize where I would be. But I did note sort of general locations and sort of time frames of where I would be moving about the Providence community.
Now, does an artist who chooses to do this kind of public performance art mm-hmm. have to get permission from anybody? Do you have to get a permission from the police? Do you have to get a peddlers
well,
it, do?
oftentimes, that's a great question. When I did some recent performances in New York City, the police were called twice. That was for a very different sort of performance piece where the encounter with people on the street was very, very different. It was much more of a physical performance as opposed to one that involved language. And the one in Providence this past weekend was very brief. You know, I walked around with a box in one hand and an umbrella in another, and stopped on various street corners, put down the box, got on top of the box, called out what I needed to call out, got off the box, and then walked away. So it was never really interfering much with any building or group or business, so there was not any altercation with Providence Police this past weekend.
Now, in my experience here in Champaign-Urbana, where this program originates, as well as in larger cities, is that there are only three types of people that sort of are speaking on the street like that.
Mm-hmm.
They might have a political agenda, they might have a religious agenda,
right.
Or they might be crazy.
Right.
Are there other options I haven't thought of?
Well, and I think that in certain communities where I move, they also could be an artist.
Okay.
You know.
And so Providence, maybe people might expect this sort of thing.
In certain areas, I mean, I think that there's always limitations when one is considering audience. And as an artist, one always has to be sort of very conscious of who it is that you anticipate will be viewing your work, and then the responsibility of how you structure the work, either to counteract those expectations or to sort of anticipate that audience or those audience members. And that's oftentimes extremely difficult when you're dealing with the kind of work that I've been engaged with recently. But I'm very interested in sort of the ambiguity of the kind of persona that I take on when I get on top of that box. Since I was on top of that box for a very brief period of time, people had to make assumptions very quickly, make judgments very quickly. And oftentimes they had to really listen to what I had to say or ask somebody that was right next to them, you know, what did he say? So I'm interested in sort of the slippery nature of how people in the situation that I was putting myself into are viewed on the street. And then if people are even paying attention to what's being said, I'm very interested in that.
I want to ask you how you chose the question, or the statement rather, I've lost faith, but let me give the phone number so that listeners can also ask you questions or make comments.
Okay.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Tom Albrecht, who is a professor of art and design here at the University of Illinois, about some of his recent performance art pieces that have some moral content, political content in some cases. If you'd like to ask him a question, call us. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free number that listeners can use wherever this program is heard, including on the Internet. And in Champaign-Urbana, we have two or three local lines that you can access by punching in 333-9455. So people in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. Elsewhere, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. So, Tom, I've lost faith. People might see someone on a soapbox in an urban area, expect them to be some kind of a preacher,
mm-hmm.
and they'd be saying the opposite.
Right.
Or trying to encourage people to somehow take a leap of faith. Why did you choose I've lost faith?
Well, I think that what I'm interested in is sort of changing sort of expectations. As you brought up earlier, I think that when I walk down the street or many other people walk down the street, and I've encountered many individuals like this in various cities that I've found myself in, and to be quite honest with you, I sometimes don't pay attention to what they're saying. Either I'm too busy or I'm not interested, and I don't stop and listen. And what I'm interested in posing the question is making people stop and paying attention to a bit of language that is, I think, disconcerting. In speaking with other people about this particular action, when an individual hears that someone has lost faith, there's an absence of something as a result. And I guess what I'm looking to see is how do people respond to that? Are people capable of listening in such a public area? Are people capable anymore of hearing that someone has perhaps lost something, that someone is in need of something? Is there empathy still available for people to hear and to respond to as a result. And the response is nothing more than a consideration of, well, what does that mean? I had one encounter with what I perceived to be a homeless person who stood right in back of me, and as I got off the box, he shouted out to me, "Well, have you lost faith in mankind?" And I turned to him, and he was smiling at me, and I smiled back at him, and I replied, "Well, I guess it's up for you to fill in the blanks." And he found that very humorous.
Hmm.
And so it was a nice encounter. And I guess, you know, when you and I were speaking about how we might title this conversation, and you brought up the idea of moral art, I actually like the idea of that, because when, you know, if you go and check your dictionary, the very first sort of designation for moral is a consideration of the implications of right or wrong. And I think in a lot of the work that I've been in investigating over the past year, I'm not so interested in providing an answer. I'm much more interested in sort of probing questions where, you know, the viewer or an audience member has to do some work and has to do some work on their own. And I'm very interested in the implications of that.
You said you used different intonations when you were standing on this soapbox and saying, "I've lost faith." Could you give me some examples?
Well,
reproduce it.
I'd probably blow out the speakers of many people listening, but I can give you some examples of how I approached a few different ways of doing it. Sometimes I would cut my hands so that my voice would be very projected over a given space. Other times I would say it actually quite softly, so that people walking by would catch a little bit of what I might say, but then might have to turn or stop and watch me go to the next street corner if they were actually interested in finding out what I actually in fact said. At other times I performed that bit of language very much like a street preacher, with my arms outstretched, with my head up to the sky, you know, calling out that I had in fact lost faith.
Was there one particular type of presentation of that phrase, "I've lost faith," that elicited a response where most of the people seemed to think you were referring to something political, perhaps the current government, the current administration, the current policies about Iraq?
Yes, and there were some instances where I was clearly, attempting to point to issues like that, where I would pound my fist into my hand and say very angrily that I had lost faith. Or if I had sort of, there was another instance where I shrugged my shoulders and sort of laughed before I said anything, and then said, you know, I'd lost faith, in a very sarcastic sort of way, or cynical sort of way. So there was many instances where that particular form of the language elicited actually a great deal of response, because I think that what it pointed to, or what people picked up on, perhaps was a loss of faith in something much more pointed to, say, the realm of politics, as opposed to the area of religion or some other instance.
Since our listeners cannot see you, tell our listeners what you look like.
Well, I might look like a typical art professor. I have thick framed glasses and a goatee and short cropped hair, and I was dressed in a very dark suit with a plain white shirt and a dark tie. So I could have passed as a business person in downtown Providence, or I could have posed as some sort of religious, either fanatic or religious person. I probably wasn't viewed as much as some crazy person on the street. I could have been perceived as a crazy art person on the street.
Tell us your ethnic background.
I am Northern European background.
Did you think when you were doing this what difference it would make if you, instead of being Northern European background or African background or Hispanic background, would people have thought you were dealing with the immigration issue, for example, if you spoke with a Spanish accent?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that obviously that would change things dramatically. And I'm very conscious of, you know, whenever I walk into a situation being, you know, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male, and I go into different urban environments, how I'm perceived, even by sort of the kind of glasses that I wear.
And the white privilege that surrounds you, whether you want it or not, is part of the performance.
Correct. And I think that, and it either adds to it or takes away from it in many instances. And unfortunately, those are things that one can be conscious of, but they can't always be completely controlled. I know that when I walked into downtown Providence, outside of the sort of neighborhoods surrounding Brown University, you walk into downtown Providence, there's much more a mixture of different ethnicities and cultures downtown, and you know, it was a very different sort of perception of me on the soapbox as opposed to me up on the hill, and so it did change quite dramatically how people viewed me. However, people when I was in the Brown University area were much less reluctant to engage with me vocally. They might give me a hand gesture, or they might acknowledge my presence with a nod. But when I was in downtown Providence, people were much more willing to engage with me vocally by either shouting something back or posing a question to me. So I was very interested in that dynamic as it set up.
This is a live call-in show every Sunday on WILL AM. Keeping the Faith. Our guest today is Tom Albrecht. We're talking about his performance art and various moral understandings of what he does. If you have a question or comment, do give us a call, 333-9455. Put you live on the air with our guest. If you're calling from the Champaign-Urbana area, elsewhere there's a toll-free number. All listeners are encouraged to use, if it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. Tom, since we haven't had any callers who ask critical questions, let me ask a couple just to keep you on your toes. why do you do this? I mean, what's the purpose?
Oh, that's a great question. I get that from my parents, actually,
sure.
quite a bit. I was actually at my father's church this morning. He was preaching during Pentecost, so it was very appropriate for him to sort of inquire as to what I was up to this weekend, and we've had some good conversations about it. For me, being a visual artist my entire life, it's been oftentimes a very solitary experience where I make work, I put it into a given space, and oftentimes that the encounter that I'm looking for as an artist hasn't quite met up with my expectations, what I'm really interested in. And in the past year, I've been very interested in making work that sort of leaves what I consider oftentimes to be a very cloistered environment or a very homogeneous environment within a gallery or museum setting where you see many of the same kinds of people. You hear many of the same conversations taking place. And I've been very interested to see what happens when you leave that space, even the comfort of that space. And for myself, going out into an urban environment, at times by myself or with a group of individuals, it's really changed the dynamic of the encounter between the work that I'm producing either in a solitary sort of experience or with a group of individuals presenting a performance, the encounter has been very, very different. And to me, that's been refreshing. It's also been extremely, I've felt very vulnerable. I think the experience this past weekend in Providence was not only me doing this sort of interruption within various public spaces in a city, but it was myself asking certain questions of myself when I go out and do this. And to me, that my engagement then is much more physical. It's much more present. And I'm interested in the implications of that as an artist.
When school starts here in the fall at the University of Illinois, there'll be quad preachers who will come here regularly and holler at people on the, passing by on the sidewalk, students trying to get their attention, saying things that are inflammatory and trying to gather a group around them of who will be in conversation. Could you imagine being in that setting and saying, "I've lost faith" from your soapbox?
Yeah, I've actually been very interested in exploring the possibilities of going to places in New York City where I know of individuals at regular certain streets or certain street corners, for that matter, and in Chicago. And I certainly know about the individuals that collect on the quad. So I am interested in the future of sort of exploring those possibilities, because I think that providing a counterpoint to that would make for a very interesting discussion, very interesting dialogue, not only between myself and the people walking by, but also between the preachers, so to speak, asking for a response. So I'm interested in that. It might happen.
Now, your situation is different than many artists have had in the past. In the past, artists have often struggled to survive as they've created their sculpture, their music, their paintings, whatever.
Right.
But occasionally they've found patrons. Artists today have that hardly ever happens. You're able to do this because you're employed by a university to teach art, right?
Correct. It's actually I consider it to be a real gift. It's a wonderful opportunity to be able to have the support of not only the University of Illinois, but the people of Illinois, to be able to do work and to make art that not only I believe in, but hopefully other people will not only find interesting and compelling, but thought-provoking at the same time.
Let's talk about some of the provocative nature of some of your pieces. For example, at the YMCA, at the University Y, where I'm the director, you've had a piece called Us and Them, or perhaps it's called U.S. and Them, because you have the two U.S. in capital letters on the as the title of the piece. And it's a body count of the U.S. dead in Iraq and the Iraqis dead on two separate panels. And it's in a very public space where there are lectures, where there are dance classes, where there are – right now we're gathering things for this huge collection we do for the Dump and Run sale next fall.
Right.
Why would you put art in a space like that, and why would you choose that?
Well, I think it goes back to what I just stated a short while ago, in that I'm very interested in art existing in unexpected places. The reason for doing the particular piece that exists at the Y right now, and I was very appreciative of the offer to place it there, is because, you know, it's not at the Krannert Art Museum. It will be encountered. At least has the opportunity to be encountered by a whole realm of different individuals going through that space, using that space, eating within that space. So the encounter is going to be very, very different than if it was at the Krannert Art Museum.
But this is a piece that has, if I may interpret it,
sure.
A point of view, a perspective. I mean, to me, it's a shocking piece to see how many people have been killed in Iraq, because we don't get those numbers typically in our news.
Right.
And it's you're taking a position on this. Somehow, at least for me, it's saying, you know, this is terrible. This is wrong. This needs to stop.
Well,
and I may be overinterpreting it, but it seems to me that, you know, you're being paid by state taxpayers, many of whom would disagree with that position.
Sure. And I think that they have a right to. I'll go back to what I said before in terms of the question of morality in art. It's not oftentimes talked about. I think it's a difficult thing to sort of talk about in terms of the ethics of art or the morality of art without sounding preachy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that most intelligent, compelling art that has been made, that continues to be made, takes a specific point of view. And even if that point of view has a great deal of ambiguity attached to it, it addresses some fundamental questions of what it means to encounter the world, either visually or nowadays with sound and new technology. It poses questions of what it means to be a thoughtful human being, and not just in a visual sense, but in oftentimes a very visceral sense. And I consider this piece to be a literal punch in the gut. It has been for me every single day that I've worked on it now, going back to last fall when it first appeared at the Krannert Art Museum, and now every week that I check the websites where I get my information, and then come in every Monday morning and update the numbers. And oftentimes it's been very difficult psychologically and physically with the many, many marks that have to be made. And I have actually received some very interesting questions from people who have taken me to task on my reasons for doing this. And I found that encounter to be actually very useful for me and hopefully for the community as well.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith with Tom Albrecht, a professor of art at the University of Illinois, about some of his recent performance pieces and other visual pieces like Us and Them, which is at the University YMCA now. If you'd like to see that particular piece, anytime the Y is open from 8:30 in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon are our summer hours. When community classes start, we'll also be open in the evening this summer. But do stop by the Y. It's at 1001 South Wright Street. We're right across from Lincoln Hall in the quadrangle of the University of Illinois. The summer's a good time to come and visit the campus because parking is much easier. And if you'd like to come and see this piece anytime the Y building is open, you may come to Latzer Hall to find it. Let me give our phone numbers again, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And we do have a caller on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes, this is very interesting. I think the great artist is blessed not only with extraordinary skill, but also enhanced insight and sensitivity. Don't you think that a moral artist should have a purpose or message more than observing a variety of responses to a highly ambiguous expression?
Could you hear that, Tom?
I could hear that. I'm wondering if the caller could clarify the question a bit more for me. I'm not quite following.
I think that it sounds like to me what your performance is simply collecting personal data on how people respond to you. And I'm wondering if you have any message to give to people as an artist.
Well, I think for me it's not just observing people and being interested myself with their response. I'm interested with what people do with language. I'm interested in how people have the capacity to even hear anymore on the street what other human beings have to say. I'm interested in that encounter. I'm interested in one human voice being able to reach another human being via language in a space that's not constructed by by anything other than a chance encounter in an urban environment. And yet, once I say that it's not constructed, that falls apart very quickly, because, as we all know, any sort of space has many layers of construction involved with it. So I don't think that I'm throwing up my hands and saying this is all ambiguous and I don't care, you know, what happens, and it's merely my means of sort of finding interest in observing human beings respond to what I say out there. I'm interested in posing some questions to people and seeing what they do with that language. And I think that there is a purpose to that. You and I can disagree about that, but I do think that there is a purpose to that. I don't think that it's meaningless at all.
I want to follow up on that in just a moment, but let me take just a short break. We're a little bit past halfway through our program of Keeping the Faith this afternoon. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for the program. Next week, we'll be playing an archive program because I'll be traveling out of state. And on June 11th, we'll be replaying an interview with Reverend Miley Palmer about the Da Vinci Code. We first did this interview when the book came out, and now that the film is out and there's renewed interest in that that work, that novel, that fiction, we'll be replaying the interview from Miley Palmer in 2004 next Sunday here on Keeping the Faith. So that's at 5 o'clock, June 11. On June 18, we'll be talking about the alcohol-free weekend that's planned for the University of Illinois campus by the Religious Workers Association. And two guests will be Reverend Brett Smith, a Baptist pastor, and Father George Pyle, Orthodox Christian priest, on June 18. On June 25, we'll be talking with Joe Teng, who is president of Students for Environmental Concerns on this campus. And the guest host will be Becca Guyette. Professor Ed Towne of Indiana will be talking about the movement in Indiana currently to try to abolish the death penalty. That'll be July 2nd. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith, a program coming up tomorrow on Afternoon Magazine here on AM 580 at 2:40. Reverend David Beckman will be the guest. He's president of Bread for the World and the Alliance to End Hunger. Celeste Quinn will be talking with him here Monday, about 2:40 on the Afternoon Magazine. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois. The Y is the oldest student organization on campus. It was started in 1873. Since that time, for 133 years now, the Y has been helping develop student leaders by providing opportunities for social action and community service. Students for Environmental Concerns, for example, has been on this campus for 30 years because of the Y, and we'll be learning more about that in a couple weeks. One of the programs that the Y is happy to co-sponsor is called the Whirlwind Project, and our guest today, Tom Albrecht, has done some art in relation to that. We'll be talking about the second part of our program. But one of the events coming up is a poetry and prose reading at the Verde Gallery next Sunday at 3 in the afternoon. So before you listen to Keeping the Faith, you could go and hear some wonderful local poets read their work. That's June 11, 3 o'clock at the Verde Gallery. Also coming up later in June, June 17, a Saturday at 2, is the Prompting Theater, giving scenes from Romeo and Juliet. That'll be at the University Y in Latzer Hall. So that's June 17, a Saturday at 2 p.m., and that's a free performance as part of the Whirlwind Project that tries to bring people together from different religious traditions or from no religious tradition to deal with interesting issues. In this case, seeing these theater pieces done by people with certain developmental disabilities is a wonderful opportunity. So those are a couple things coming up. Let me encourage people to remember the Y Dump and Run program. If you have things which would be useful to students to set up apartments, housewares, furniture, things like that, do collect them this summer and bring them to the Stock Pavilion next August. Between August 15 and 19, we'll be accepting gifts from the community, which the Y will then include as part of our huge sale, where we sell things very cheaply, but it raises money for the Y. It keeps things out of the trash stream, and many entering students, particularly international students, are delighted to pay $5 for a desk or $15 for a sofa. And if you'd like to contribute to that, that's the Y's Dump and Run program, August 15 through 19. We are having a sale July 9, Saturday in the morning, July 8, of things for children that we've already received. So remember July 8th to come Saturday morning, July 8th, for our sale of kids' things. We have another caller waiting to talk with our guest, Tom Albrecht. Let's go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Please forgive a ramble here. The previous caller suggested that having a point, having a thrust would be significant. If we talk about Guernica, I think there certainly is a message and an imperative that's stated as far as that piece is concerned. And then the previous caller went on to say, well, if you're or to imply in my mind at any rate that if you're saying I've lost faith. I've lost faith in different ways that there is no focus and that there is that the thrust that you have does just become personal. You're gathering these personal observations of what your impression of the reaction is, and it has very little meaning for. To you that, however, you know, so that's my sort of embroidery of the previous caller. But what I was going to go on to ask is if you set it in sort of a desperate and pleading kind of way, do you create an obligation for response among some people who might be of helping or nurturing profession or simply a personal bent? And if there is a response, maybe some anxiety that you've created, what obligation do you have in respect to their response? If they go home and they without understanding that you're a performance artist sit meditating in with some depression, have you an obligation to that response?
Well, I mean, I think you raise some very interesting questions in terms of the responsibility of the artist. I think that any artist has a certain amount of responsibility in terms of what one puts out into the world. Many artists, however, have argued that the responsibility ends at the making of the work, that once work goes out into the world, whether it be an object or a performance piece such as this, that it is then the responsibility of the individuals who encounter it to sort out the messiness or the meaning, therefore, of what they've encountered, of what they've viewed, of what they've listened to. And I think that that would be my response to that particular question. I think it's incredibly important. But I do believe that there is some responsibility on the part of individuals encountering art to do some work as well. So I'm not interested in pure ambiguity. There is a reason why I'm doing the work that I'm doing. I have a sincere interest in people encountering the work and posing questions back, even questions such as the ones that I'm getting via the phone calls. I'm interested in that dialogue, and I think that that can be a very, very useful function of art in its varied forms.
When I was mentioning the Whirlwind Project and some of the events coming up here in Champaign-Urbana related to that, I mentioned that you had done a piece, but I didn't talk about it much. Tell us about the piece you did on bread, The Art of Being Neighbors.
Right. Well, my involvement with Whirlwind has been a really great experience because there's many people who sit down at the table who have very different ideas, and I think that's always a really healthy thing. And it makes for a very challenging then discussion about when we talk about what it means to believe in something, what it means to believe in this idea or that idea. In this particular case this year with The Art of Being Neighbors, what does it mean to be a neighbor? What does that entail? Whether you're coming out of a background that has a religious faith or not, what does it mean to encounter another individual next door to you, walking down the street? And in this particular sense, for me, such a profound symbol of that encounter is the sharing of bread that is not necessarily specifically culturally based, but it crosses, varied cultures historically. It's a basic staple in many diets throughout the world, but it also has served in many cultures as a symbol of community, as a symbol of sharing, as a symbol of hospitality. And to break bread with other individuals and to share it, it goes beyond just sharing sustenance. It goes to the idea of sitting down together, having a discussion, sharing a meal with other people. And to me, that has sort of profound implications for what Whirlwind wanted to bring up in terms of its many events this year. So my first idea was having a bread exchange where people could bake bread and exchange it with other individuals that they would come into a local space in Champaign-Urbana and be able to not only share bread but be able to have a conversation with people perhaps they had never met before.
We have another caller waiting to speak with our guest, Tom Albrecht, about moral art. You're on the air. Line number one. Go right ahead.
Yes, I was very intrigued with the topic of moral art, but not particularly. I wasn't very wise about that, but I'm involved in the Whirlwind Project, and so I wanted to ask how I know how these two things relate. We want to become better neighbors, and what better time than at Pentecost, which I think is very important to reach out. So my question to you is, how do you think you have been able to achieve this, reaching out and becoming better neighbors through your moral art or through breaking bread? And I'll hang up and listen to your response off the air.
Well, thanks so much for the question. I think that growing up, as the son of a minister, I was always sort of in an environment where I had to encounter people that I didn't know very well. I had to deal with adults, and I constantly had to be in different situations where I had to consider what I said and how I acted and the implications of those decisions. So I think that in terms of the artwork that I make, it's fundamentally rooted in how I was raised, and it's fundamentally rooted in a belief system which is about a certain kind of encounter between one person and another, and hopefully multiple individuals. If you're an artist, you don't necessarily want to be just reaching one person. You're hoping to encounter many. And I think that really is sort of a fundamental question that always comes up, whether it be work that's produced in a solitary studio environment or whether it's work that's being performed or initiated in a much more public space. To me, it really comes down to a conversation that gets established through the work, and whether that is a conversation that doesn't necessarily take place face-to-face, hopefully it's a dialogue that begins to be started and is taken into that other individual's life and is considered. Hopefully, the ideal would be to have an actual conversation or dialogue with an individual who has encountered my work and be able to both take something away from that discussion. An interview such as this provides an opportunity for that, and I think it's a wonderful experience.
Let me just clarify that although most Mondays, Tom Albrecht has been able to come to the University Y to add to the piece Us and Them that's on display there about the Iraq casualties. Because he's traveling, he will not be there tomorrow, of course. Do you know when you will be back, Tom?
I will be back the following Monday.
The following Monday. And about 10 o'clock, if people would like to witness this addition to the piece, it's really quite moving.
Correct.
And a chance to also talk with Tom or ask him questions face-to-face. I know he does welcome that, as he just said, but he also welcomes conversation here on the air. We do have time for another call or two. The numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Elsewhere, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And, of course, these programs are archived and available at WILL.UIUC.edu, and then go to AM 580 and then to Keeping the Faith. And in a couple weeks, this program will be available there for several years. So if you've missed the early part of this interview and like to learn more about Tom Albrecht and his work, do check it out online. These programs are podcast live as well, and we know we have listeners many places who listen via their computers. So do feel free to use our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455, if you have a question or comment. Tom, listeners may not have heard you before when you were on this program and may not know your background. Tell us about how you were educated in terms of both art and religion.
Well, as I think I mentioned briefly before, I was raised the son of a Lutheran minister who's still practicing. He's serving as an interim minister currently on Cape Cod and has been doing that for the past several years. So I was raised in the ELCA tradition of the Lutheran Church. I did my undergraduate education at Rhode Island School of Design in Providence, so it was a little bit like coming home this past weekend. I hadn't been back in quite some time. I went on from there to get a Master's of Arts in Religion from Yale University, where I attended the Divinity School and the Yale Institute of Sacred Music. And from there, I went on to receive my Master of Fine Arts in Painting from the University of Washington in Seattle.
Do you still do the kind of visual art that is not necessarily political?
Yes. I mean, I do work that I think is actually all fundamentally connected, whether it is on the surface or not, or is readily seen. I had an exhibition recently that was entitled Embodied, and I think that most of my work has to deal with not only the encounter between the art object and the individual encountering the art object. It really has to do in the making of the work itself. So a lot of my drawings and paintings deal primarily with the idea of a mark and its repetition and its relationship to other marks. I teach drawing at the School of Art and Design, and one of the fundamental ideas of that I try to get across to students is that a mark can be a different kind of language when considered properly in the making of a drawing. And depending on what material you're using and the surface that you lay it down on, You know, the pressure that you exert on the material and the direction of your hand and the movement of your hand, all of those things are significant. And so in the work that I do that is not necessarily could be considered political oftentimes has to deal primarily with the body's response in terms of making marks on a particular surface.
Where was the exhibition embodied?
That was at a small liberal arts school by the name of Greenville College down in southern Illinois.
And do you have another exhibition coming up, scheduled somewhere, that people listening might see some of your work?
Well, I have one coming up in October in Scotland. that's the next one. So that might be a little bit of a trip for some people.
And will you go to Scotland yourself for that?
Yes, I will be. I will be setting that up, and I will be giving a lecture in tandem with that exhibition. So,
in terms of your future plans, do you have some more performance art that you're intending to throw out there?
Well, there's a number of events scheduled that. Hopefully will take place this summer. There's one that I'll be doing the piece that I did in Providence in Brooklyn during a weekend-long festival in September.
And do you have a website where people can go to see where you might be doing performance art?
Actually, the website should be up within the next month. And at this point in time, I don't have a website address, but okay. That is forthcoming.
So people will just have to go to Tom Albrecht on Google and the artist and
right.
And find that. How is your last name spelled?
It'll probably be posted as Thomas Albrecht, and my last name is spelled Albrecht.
Thomas Albrecht.
And I would assume it'll probably be thomasalbrecht.com or .org, and they should see that up within about the next month.
I want to thank our guest for dealing with some of my rude questions about his art, but he knows I appreciate his work very much, and we've been happy to have it at the University Y. We are out of time. Let me thank our callers for their questions and remind listeners that next week we'll have an archive program from Keeping the Faith, Miley Palmer, back in 2004, had a very interesting program on the Da Vinci Code. Since that's now out in film, that'll be here at 5 o'clock, June 11th. On June 18, our guests will be Brett Smith and Father George Pyle talking about an alcohol-free weekend that's being planned for the University of Illinois campus next fall. Joe Tang will be our guest June 25th, talking about Students for Environmental Concerns. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs and director of the University Y, which provides support for Keeping the Faith. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
They can talk to the angels, they're intuitive, and their aura is an unusual vivid blue. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, we'll find out about indigo children. The New Age movement says they're here to save the world, but modern medicine says they're normal kids with attention deficit disorder. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. Tonight at 8 on WILL-TV, match wits with Agatha Christie's famous spinster sleuth, Miss Marple. Geraldine McEwen returns in 4 new episodes, beginning with The Sleeping Murder. Don't miss Mystery tonight at 8 on our companion station, WILL-TV, PBS for Central Illinois. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, clear with a low in the lower 50s and east winds around 10 miles per hour this evening, becoming light. Tomorrow, sunny with a high in the lower 80s and southeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with the low in the upper 50s and south winds around 10 miles per hour in the evening, becoming light. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.